This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're just back from an invigorating trip to Capitol Hill to speak with our lawmakers and policy leaders on health reform, which happened to coincide with the third anniversary of the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
Hard to believe it's been 3 years, but it was an exciting conference. It's organized by the National Association of Community Health Centers, better known as NAHC, which works to support the nation's 8,000 community health centers, which do so much to serve the underserved of our population.
And while we were there, the Senate was working feverishly towards approving a budget resolution, which they managed to do over the weekend. The Democratic-controlled Senate narrowly passed its first budget in 4 years.
But this is a far different document than the Ryan budget that was passed in the House, which was attempting to fix the deficit by enacting $5 trillion in budget cuts, and those cuts would have largely been to social programs like health care and education.
The Senate budget took a more balanced approach with a mix of tax increases and less severe cuts to programs. But it's not over till it's over, and I expect will be some more contentious arguments over these vastly different approaches to balancing the budget. So we'll keep an eye on all of this activity.
Our guest today is taking a different approach to primary health care delivery. Dr. Rishika Fernandopoulay is the founder and CEO of Iora Health. That's a Cambridge-based startup that's seeking to reinvent primary care from the ground up.
He's been lauded by several noted healthcare industry analysts as a real innovator with his care model.
And we'll also be hearing from Lori Robertson, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She's always uncovering misrepresented facts about health policy that appear in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio. And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
And we'll get to our interview with Rishika Fernandopoulay in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. On the third anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, polls show Americans are either still conflicted or downright confused in understanding what the law really means. The president, as well as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, came out on the third anniversary this week with statements in support of the health care law, saying it would improve access to health care for a struggling middle class and was already serving to improve health care for millions of Americans, the young adults retaining coverage on their parents' plans to the millions who are getting free preventive screenings. Meanwhile, a monthly Kaiser Family Foundation poll shows Americans are just as divided or misinformed about what the health care law will mean for them. As has been the case all along, the poll found the central elements of the law remain popular across party lines, up to 70% approving things like providing tax credits to small businesses to help employees afford insurance, closing the Medicare prescription drug donut hole, and creating insurance marketplaces where individuals and small businesses can buy that coverage. CEO of Kaiser Family Foundation, Drew Altman, says while the political fight around the Affordable Care Act may be winding down, the challenge still lies ahead of how best to introduce the law to a public that really still doesn't understand it. Meanwhile, one of the provisions of the law, the expansion of Medicaid to include more folks living close to the poverty line, was not held up by last year's Supreme Court decision on the health care law. A number of Republican-led states have refused to comply with the provision, but one state is creating ripples across the landscape, Arkansas. They've created a third option, enroll those newly eligible for Medicaid in the same private insurance plans available to individuals and small businesses on the exchanges. Arkansas is led by a Democratic governor, but a Republican-controlled legislature, and it seemed the only viable option. Bottom line, it would make it possible for another 250,000 folks in Arkansas to have some health coverage. The baristas might be onto something. Several studies out about the medicinal powers of coffee reveal a whole host of beneficial side effects to the hot simmering brew. A recent study finds coffee does in fact lead to more alert truckers on the road. A recent Australian study showed that long-haul truckers driving big rigs were 63% less likely to have an accident if they regularly consumed coffee. And another study out shows that for folks who drink alcohol regularly, coffee seems to have a protective effect on the liver, keeping it from succumbing so readily to the toxic side effects of regular alcohol consumption. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Rushika Fernando-Bolay, co-founder and CEO of Iora Health, an innovative Cambridge-based startup that is seeking to transform healthcare delivery in this country. Dr. Fernando-Bolay was the first executive director for the Harvard Interfaculty Program for Health Systems Improvement and co-founded the Boston-based Renaissance Health. He was featured as an innovator in Dr. Atul Gawande's New Yorker article, Hotspotter. Dr. Fernando-Bolay is on the faculty at Harvard Medical School, where he received his MD. Dr. Fernando-Bolay, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Fernando-Bolay, you say that the healthcare system is failing us and needs to be reinvented, starting with the primary care system. So, you're in the process of creating a new approach to the delivery of healthcare, one that you say is reinventing the model of healthcare delivery from scratch, a model that can be both effective, and I'm going to add efficient and maybe elegant as well, and ultimately lowering the cost of healthcare over time. Describe for us how this system is failing us first and why we need to essentially reinvent the wheel in healthcare delivery.
The gap between what we pay for healthcare and the quality of the services we receive in this country is, I think, probably the biggest business problem that faces us. We spend an obscene amount of money on healthcare. It's 17 or 18% of our GDP. It's $2.5 trillion. It's bankrupting individuals. It's bankrupting companies who can't compete internationally. And it's bankrupting the country. If you look at federal budget deficits over the next 50 years, they're really all being driven by Medicare and Medicaid going up. And we have to get a handle on healthcare spending. You know, we're spending so much, but yet the quality we get is awful. Anyone who's tried to get healthcare knows that it's depersonalized, it's fragmented, it's reactive, and the outcomes are embarrassingly poor. The 30-day readmission rate for Medicare is 21%. You know, defect rates like that would be a cause for huge alarm in any other industry. We think primary care is the right place to start. If you want to fix healthcare, you've got to fix practices. The bulk of the challenge in healthcare today is chronic disease. It's diabetes, hypertension, lung disease, and primary care is a great place to manage that. And I think there's the movement toward medical homes and accountable care. What everyone else is doing is trying to tweak existing primary care practices, take existing practices and make them a little better by changing a little thing here, giving them a computer, adding email, but by and large leaving the rest the same. And our proposition has simply been that why don't we just start from scratch? The system is so fundamentally broken that maybe what we need to do is actually just start over, break the rules, and create a new model that can really deliver care in a very different way.
Tell us about that model. Tell us how you threw out all the rules and started all over again. What did you build?
The first part of the model is really changing the payment model. So the way that we pay most doctors in this country, and virtually all primary care doctors, is what we call fee-for-service. You get paid per sick visit. So you come to see me, the doctor, I do whatever. I do a diagnosis, I give you a treatment. I then assign a code. It's a thing called CPT code. Very arcane set of rules. And then I bill, and then I may or may not get paid for that sick visit. So we get paid per doctor sick visit. Guess what happens? We get lots of doctor sick visits, and we don't at all focus on actually improving people's health. Primary care is really about a continuous healing relationship. The way for pay for a relationship is like a gym membership. It's a fixed amount per month to just allow us to figure out how to take care of people. And number two is primary care in the U.S. is typically about 4% of the healthcare dollar. That's ridiculous. That means that 96% is what I call failure of primary care. You end up in the hospital, the emergency room. So what we say is we should double down on primary care. We should put at least double the resources into it. That will actually keep people out of trouble on the back end. The second piece is that now allows us to be completely creative in changing the delivery model. And so it really is about getting a team of people to work with the patient, to help them with all the blocking and tackling it takes to manage your health. And we have a concept of a health coach, which is someone from the community who is not necessarily a nurse or a doctor, but someone with good interpersonal skills who can really help patients make a plan, know what to track, answer questions. And we just think it's so much more powerful to do it from the community, live in person. Everyone gets a shared care plan where we make a plan of how we're going to improve your health, whether it's losing weight or learning to run a marathon or whatever. And then we can interact with you in a whole variety of ways. So not just visits, but this is 2013. We should be able to interact by email, by text message, by video chat, and we do all of those things. A lot of our interactions are in groups. So people with diabetes, we have a diabetes club, a yoga group, ways to engage people so patients can engage each other. We integrate mental health into the practice, because a lot of the barriers to getting good health care is actually depression or anxiety, and we should be helping that, not just trying to send you off somewhere else. And then the third part of the model really is when you start doing this completely different care delivery, what I call population management, you realize that the IT systems we have in typical healthcare are completely wrong. Despite all the, you know, hoo-ha about electronic medical records, what they really are fancy billing systems to allow doctors to code, document, and bill higher. Doesn't improve care at all. And we realized we need a different sort of IT system to help us actually manage populations, engage patients in their care. And so that we've built that ourselves.
I wonder how you see this spread happening. And maybe you can talk a little bit about Iora Health and the team that you've assembled there. But it seems that you're going to have to connect with enough businesses who are willing to, or government entities who are willing to change that payment model. And that really drives so much of the opportunities for the redesign and redefinition of that primary care space. And then having the technical capabilities of using, managing data efficiently. And is this concept that you think can spread, and talk to us how you think it might spread?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. So the constraint on our growth at the moment is finding what I call sponsors, which are people who are on the hook for healthcare spending, who are willing to pay us differently. Now, again, I think that the way we're doing it now doesn't work, so we should be trying all sorts of different things. Mm-hmm. But as you know, change is hard for many, many folks. We've had the most success, you know, signing up with either large self-insured employers like the Boeing Company, like Dartmouth College, we have a practice up in Hanover, New Hampshire, as well as union trusts. So in many places, parts of the country, the union trust is who's been delegated the authority to sort of provide health benefits. So in Las Vegas, we work with the Casino Workers Union, work with a group called the Freelancers Union in New York and Brooklyn. So you're exactly right. So what we need to do is find more payers who are willing to pay us differently. Now, I think what's going to make this work and get this to big scale is what's happening in health reform, which is really patients more and more buying health care themselves. As you know, with these exchanges coming on board and with changes in employers, many employers are likely over the next 5 or so years to stop providing insurance to folks. I think many employers are going to start saying, instead of us providing you health insurance, we're going to give you, you know, X thousand dollars a year, go buy yourself a health plan on one of these exchanges. So now all of a sudden, consumers are able to go and purchase a product. And again, I think what we're doing in New York is we're bundling our practice with a health plan together as one offering, and that's something that consumers very much like.
But I wonder, Dr. Fernando Pillay, if you could tell us a little more about these primary care teams. We know from what you wrote about the Atlantic City experience, these were patients who, beyond needing a little, they really needed a lot because they were using an awful lot of care in the emergency room. So tell us about the people you put on that primary care team. How did you engage those patients in their care?
You hit the nail right on the head. The most important thing we need to do is engage patients. We are then able to sort of help them manage their health better, change behavior, et cetera. That's where our health coaches come in. And, you know, a quick story. We had a patient in Atlantic City, as he said, her name was Joyce, and she came into the practice completely out of control. Her diabetes was out of control. Her blood pressure was out of control. She was in and out of the emergency room, not taking her medication, sort of disheveled looking. Came into the practice, and then 6 months later, I saw her, and she looked amazing. She was put some makeup on, her hair was combed, diabetes and hypertension in good control, taking her meds, back to work, no ER visits. And I said, Joyce, what did we do different? What have we done to really help you? She said, well, actually, Doc, it's pretty simple. My health coach, Millie, cared about me. She taught me to care about myself, and I didn't want to let either of us down. So it was almost that simple, right? So all this other stuff we're doing, all to mediate that relationship between the patient, the doctor, and their health coach, to engage people in their care so they can start paying attention and start making changes. And that's why the team is so important. I think there's too much focus has been on the doctor. The doctor is what I call the system architect, but a lot of the impact is actually not by the doctor, it's by the other folks on the team.
We're speaking today with Dr. Roshika Fernanda Pillay, co-founder and CEO of an innovative Cambridge-based startup that is seeking to transform healthcare delivery in this country. So talk to us a little bit about the IT systems that you've developed.
So we've built our system from the ground up, like we built our practice from the ground up, in order to mediate sort of better care. So it's built around actually tracking the things that we think we ought to track for each patient to maximize their health. For instance, if you're a diabetic, we have a thing called markers, and there are a number of markers we should be tracking, your hemoglobin A1C, your blood pressure, your LDL, whether you had a foot exam. So we program all those things in, and we track how you're doing. We call the Care Collaboration Platform. And it allows everyone on the team, including the patient, to see the record and interact with it and actually even put information into it. So what we do is we have task lists associated with each person on the team, including the patient and the health coach and the doctor. And the system keeps track of all the things we need to do. If the system sees that a patient has an A1C that's overdue, it puts a task on the health coach's task list to get a hold of the patient and tell them they need an A1C checked. Similarly, if we prescribe a medicine, we get a feed from the pharmacy benefit manager, and we look to see for a fill. And if the patient didn't fill the medicine within 48 hours, we put a task on the health coach's task list for that patient to reach out, why didn't you pick up your medicine? We get data from everywhere. We get census data from the hospitals in the market, so we know when our patients are in the hospital or in the ER. And patients can input in data from, you know, their blood pressure or their glucometer, or then when things go off the rails, we then can reach out and figure out what happened. We also can create some very elaborate dashboards, so we poll our patients and get patient experience data, and we also get all the claims data from our sponsors, because they're the payers, to know when people are in the hospital in the ER and go to specialists and get imaging tests. So we can now create these 360-degree dashboards where we can see how is each patient doing, how is each health coach doing with their patients, and how is each practice doing. If you look at just one of them, you can get into trouble. It's in the cloud. It's Ruby on Rails. It's used to a thing called agile development, where every 2 weeks we have a new release. And so as we figure out there are ways we can do things better, we can feed it back to our team, and we can change the system so it can be made better. So every 2 weeks, it keeps improving.
Dr. Fernandopoulet, let's put our policy hats on for just a moment. And obviously, cost containment is a holy grail. Maybe tell us a little bit about that, and then I want to just follow up for a minute on primary care providers to patient ratios. So maybe first on cost.
I think whenever people set out to try and save healthcare costs, it's too tempting to do the wrong thing and just skimp on care. What we've been able to see, if you take our patients and compare them to control group, what you find is that the primary care costs go up because that's the model. Drug spending actually goes up a little bit because people actually take their medications. But then there are big, roughly 50% drops in emergency room visits. About a 25% drop in other outpatient costs, and the net spending drops by anywhere from 12 or 13% up to 20% in our Boeing project. So big drops in total spending. This is, you know, better care, cheaper. And it's cheaper because we're actually doing the right thing for patients.
And if I can just ask you a quick follow-up question to that again, sort of from a policy perspective. We've kind of grown up in this country over the last decades thinking one primary care provider could care for somewhere between 1,200 and 2,000 patients. And then the concierge movement came along and people said, well, we can do a great job as long as we're only taking care of 300 or 400. What is your sense of the impact of your model and your primary care teams? How many patients can they manage? And is that a question you've even tried to tackle?
It's a very important question. You know, so the game is should not be to squeeze primary care as much as possible, right? Primary care is 4% of the healthcare dollar. So if the right thing to do is spend more on primary care, we should be doing that. I think what the concierge practices do is simply have a doctor if fewer patients is a dumb way to do it, because much of the value can be delivered by people who is not the doctor. What we ask the question is, what are the things that the doctor should do, because that's what we're trained to do, and what are the things that you don't need a doctor to do? And then I think engaging patients and tracking things and, you know, it's actually better done by someone else. I think we can have patients do a lot more things self-service than we do now. So we actually think that we will eventually have doctors who can take care of more patients than doctors do now. Again, leveraged by teams. So to be clear, in our practices, for every doctor, we have four health coaches, plus an admin person, plus a mental health person. So that's a big team of non-physicians who really can help with this. You asked the question, will we have enough doctors out there? You know, I think part of the reason people aren't going to primary care is not just the money, which is what everyone focuses on. Primary care doctors get paid about half as much as many specialists do. It really is that the job simply sucks. You know, the typical primary care job, I had a colleague who once said, you know, every day I lose a little piece of my soul because I went into this thinking that I'd be able to take good care of my patients, and I'm just not able to. And I think what we're trying to do is provide settings where doctors can take great care of their patients. And we have no problem attracting great docs to work in our practices, and our doctors are incredibly happy. So I think if we do that, we create a different vision of what primary care is, we will have no problem attracting as many people as we want going into primary care.
Dr. Fernandopoulet, we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations that our listeners at Conversation should be keeping an eye on?
I think that some of the sort of engagement tools and some of the things that allow patients to track and take control of their own disease, as well as particularly in communities, are really interesting. So there are these communities of patients who are essentially helping each other better manage their health. And I think allowing patients to do a lot more self-service than we do in typical practices is really interesting. And, you know, I think it's a great time to be doing this sort of work.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Rushika Fernando-Poulet, founder and CEO of Iora Health, a groundbreaking healthcare company that's seeking to transform healthcare delivery by improving patient outcomes and dramatically reducing costs in the process. You can learn more about the work that he does by going to iorahealth.com.
Conversations on healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, last week was the third anniversary of President Obama signing the Affordable Care Act. And last week, Republican Representative Michelle Bachmann claimed in a speech on the House floor that Congress should repeal the law, quote, before it literally kills women, kills children, kills senior citizens. She also claimed that vulnerable women, children, and seniors would, quote, pay more and get less under the law. The law is expected to increase the number of Americans with health insurance by 27 million in the next 4 years. And studies show that those who lack insurance have a higher risk of dying prematurely. As for women, children, and seniors paying more, well, the law provides free preventive services for women, such as mammograms and cervical cancer screenings. It increases prescription drug coverage for seniors, and it extends funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program for 2 more years. Bachmann has long been suspicious of the healthcare law's independent payment advisory board, which she has claimed will ration care. But the board is tasked with suggesting ways to slow the growth of Medicare spending, and the law says it can't restrict benefits or care for seniors. The facts simply don't support Bachmann's claims. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. On any given night in Greater Los Angeles, there are 100,000 homeless people sleeping on the streets or in shelters. And though it may be hard to imagine, there is a growing roster of UCLA students among those numbers. The down economy and the rise in tuition in the University of California system has forced some students living on the edge to forego basic needs, including paying for housing. A couple of years ago, awareness of the homeless student problem sparked an idea. Several student groups on the UCLA campus joined forces with the university's housing and food service departments to create Swipes for the Homeless.
Swipes for the Homeless is founded on the principle that each and every student can make a positive, tangible change in their community.
Every quarter, students that live on campus purchase meal swipes that get put onto their student ID and get them into the dining halls. At the end of every quarter, students typically have 10, 20, even 100 meal swipes remaining.
Co-founders Tak Nguyen and Rachel Sumick explained the concept, which was pretty simple, but prevented a lot of waste of end semester prepaid food service dollars that would end up unused.
At the end of each quarter, we collect hundreds of signatures and then collaborate with dining to turn those signatures into meals. Our team then distributes these massive quantities of food to shelters throughout Los Angeles.
They launched the idea at UCLA in 2009, and as of January of this year, they have spread to universities across the country. Since its inception, the program has distributed roughly 60,000 pounds of food and water to numerous homeless shelters around the country. And the added benefit, the kids on the campus get a valuable lesson in the pervasiveness of homelessness. The founder of Swipes for the Homeless have won numerous awards for their idea and were invited to the White House last year for their efforts. A simple repurposing of unused meal plan dollars, redirecting those previously wasted resources to a population right in their own own community who are in need. Now, that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.